All right, this morning we're doing something we do probably once a year, and it's where I just read the story and I say, okay, on Sunday I'm just going to read the story, I'm going to sit in a stool, which I never do, and I'm going to read the story with some commentary, and then have a very simple point, because sometimes these stories, they're just, what is this? So I'm just going to read it and let you figure it out, or we'll kind of figure it out together, or we'll just leave confused. But hopefully not. So we're in 1 Samuel 14. And the last time we did this was a story of Jesus and John, and that just seems to work a lot better than these, but hey, we're going to go for it. And as we've been doing every Sunday in 1 Samuel, some context, because again, this is all part of a larger narrative, a larger story. Think of it as a TV series we've used. And when you see previously on whatever show, they give you kind of the highlight points that you're going to want to know for that series, that episode. Similar this morning. So here's the recap. Previously in 1 Samuel, remember, it began in Judges. In those days, Israel had no king. Judges is a book of weirdness, violence, messed up everything. And you can see that the authors of the book give this foreshadow of the reason all of this is happening, because in those days, Israel had no king. We didn't have a king. So we get to 1 Samuel. The first thing that happens is there's a barren woman who asks a priest, Eli, for a child. And the priest says, may God give you your wish. And the woman has a son named Samuel. Samuel ends up living with the priest, Eli. Eli's sons, we've talked about them, were evil and did evil in the eyes of the Lord. Ended up dying this horrific death on the same day their dad died, and one of the sons' wife while giving birth to Ichabod. We said no one names their kid Ichabod for that reason, because God has left Israel now, she said, as she gives birth and dies. We'll get to Ichabod in a minute. And Samuel becomes this priest leader. There's some wars. They bring the ark. They lose. The ark gets captured. People get tumors. Some of this is ringing a bell. Some of you are saying, I might need to read 1 Samuel because that sounds weird. It is. They get tumors. The ark comes back. Everyone dies. When they look in the ark, Samuel then leads Israel into a victory against the Philistines. The Philistines are throughout the story, always the enemy, always at war with the Philistines. Right after Samuel, the priest leader, who's finally leading people, Israel, in the right way, leads them into victory. They throw away their other gods. The people say, we want a king. Samuel gets a little ticked off. God, they want a king. Don't worry, they're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me. Give them a king, but warn them all the things a king will do. So he does that. The people still say they want a king, and we have Saul, who we've talked about in numerous ways. Most people will say Saul was this evil man with no heart for God, to which I might say, well, there's some reason Saul was, and we decided to look at the story with a little bit of grace, and you start to see why Saul maybe is the way that he is. But regardless, last week we talked about a mistake of Saul, which is hard to find a mistake, and maybe it was a mistake of Samuel, and the story ended with things are not good. Everyone has left Saul, and he's basically left with not many soldiers and the Philistines on the horizon to attack. That's how last week ended, okay? And that brings us to 1 Samuel 14, which is where we're at. So here we go. Now, a detachment of Philistines had gone out to the pass at Michmash. Just so you know, there are a ton of Hebrew words in here, which I do not know how to pronounce. But I'm going to go with it with confidence, and it will make you think I do know how to pronounce them, and that's fine. I looked up some of them, but it got to a point where I'm not going to look up all these. I'll never say them again. And unless there's a professor in here, they won't know I'm saying them the wrong way anyway. So, one day, Jonathan, son of Saul, this is the first time Jonathan enters the picture, son of Saul, said to his young armor bearer, come, let's go over to the Philistine outpost on the other side. But he did not tell his father. So Jonathan and his armor bearer, let's go to the other side. Let's go to the Philistine outpost. Saul was staying on the outskirts of Gibeah under a pomegranate tree in Migron. Now, when I read stuff like this, certain things stand out. A pomegranate tree. We don't have a lot of details in a lot of the stories of the Bible, and yet we know it was a pomegranate tree. Of all the things, this story has probably been told orally for year after year, and then maybe written down here and there, and somebody collects the story hundreds of years later, and they write down sitting under a pomegranate tree. Which makes me say, well, why? Why was that important? And I don't really know why, but pomegranate is interesting. The priests were to wear an ephod, which is kind of this breastplate robe thing. And on the bottom of it, God directed them, or at least they believe God did in Exodus, to put pomegranates of yarn on the bottom, interspersed with bells. So there's this instruction to dress the priests with a pomegranate decoration. Kind of interesting. When they were saved and rescued out of Egypt, the Israelites complained, man, can we just go back to Egypt where we had pomegranates to eat and vines and grapes? Grapes that grew on the vines, really. Vines aren't that tasty. Go back to the land where we had pomegranates. And then there's other passages where God promises them a land flowing with honey and where the fruit will grow on the vines and figs and pomegranates. So there's lots of interesting symbolism from this whole idea, and I don't know actually which one you want to take from it, but I do find it interesting that they're sitting under a pomegranate tree. Maybe it's even, oh, remember that land God promised us? Yeah, we were there, and things actually weren't that great, potentially. Okay, with him were about 600 men, which remember there were thousands before this, among whom was Ahijah, who was wearing an ephod, so that's the breastplate thing with the pomegranates. He was a son of Ichabod's brother, Ahitub, son of Phinehas, the son of Eli, the Lord's priest in Shiloh. No one was aware that Jonathan had left. So now we have Ichabod mentioned again, and this is a relative of Eli whose sons did evil. Remember this whole story. It's kind of interesting that they're all sitting under this pomegranate tree, relaxing, chilling. The priest has an ephod with pomegranates on it, and Eli's descendants are there, who Eli was out of the picture for doing evil. God was saying, I'm wiping your family out. Remember, none of your descendants will ever be this again. They'll all die in the prime of their life, this terrible curse that we talked about. And here are his descendants as the priests sitting with the king. Interesting little story developing here. Some of these things that were foretold seem to not be necessarily happening. But either way, they're sitting there. They're not aware Jonathan left. On each side of the pass that Jonathan intended to cross to reach the Philistine outpost was a cliff. One was called Bozez and the other Sena. One cliff stood to the north toward Michmash, the other to the south toward Geba. Jonathan said to his young armor bearer, come, let's go over to the outpost of those uncircumcised men. Again, that's just an insult. Everyone else was uncircumcised except the Israelites, so let's go over to those losers, our enemy. Perhaps the Lord will act in our behalf. Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving, whether by many or by few. So there's these cliff walls. Jonathan says, let's go for this Philistine outpost because nothing can stop God if God wants us to kill them all or do whatever God wants us to do. So the armor bearer says, do all that you have in mind. Go ahead, I am with you, heart and soul. Pause right there. That is a friend. Because I would have said, you're an idiot, go ahead. I don't buy this whole God will protect us thing. Maybe I just didn't have faith. This armor bearer says, I am with you, heart and soul. Whatever you want to do, I am with you. Heart and soul, every part of my being is with you. You have a friend like that? Keep them. If you don't feel bad. Most people don't. That was pessimistic. If you don't, you be that friend. And then you'll find one. Sorry, I don't want to be pessimistic anymore. Okay. Jonathan said, come on then. Great, you're with me. We will cross over toward them and let them see us. That's interesting. If they say to us, wait there until we come to you, we will stay where we are until and not go up to them. But if they say, come up to us, we will climb up because that will be our sign that the Lord has given them into our hands. Again, armor bearer, much props to you. Hey, if they say wait here, we'll wait there. If they say come up to us, we'll go up to them because that is a sign. Okay. So both of them showed themselves to the Philistine outpost. "Look," said the Philistines, "the Hebrews are crawling out of the holes they are hiding in." The men at the outpost shouted to Jonathan and his armor bearer, "Come up to us and we'll teach you a lesson." Now at that point, I would have been, if I'm the armor bearer, did that one count? Because you didn't say if they'll teach us a lesson, because that doesn't sound good. So Jonathan said to his armor bearer, "Climb up after me. The Lord has given them into the hand of Israel." Wow, okay. Jonathan climbed up using his hands and feet. Sorry, I just had to pause there. What else would he have been using? Again, the details. I'm picturing this father telling his young son, "And Jonathan climbed using his hands and feet." Oh, okay. I guess he could have just used his hands. Would have been like Rambo or something, just super strong guy, but he had to use his feet also. Okay, with his armor bearer right behind him, presumably also using his hands and feet, but doesn't say. The Philistines fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer followed and killed behind him. In that first attack, Jonathan and his armor bearer killed some 20 men in the area of about half an acre. Now, I will say, a lot of times you read these stories and they just, you know, Samson kills whatever, 1,000 people. You're like, what? This one seems realistic. 20 guys, okay, Jonathan's a stud. I mean, this guy can fight like the best of them. Half an acre, they're going through them like 300 or Lord of the Rings, whatever. I mean, you can picture it. They're just, and the armor bearer's right behind them. So they kill 20 men. Then panic struck the whole army. Those in the camp and field, and those in the outposts and raiding parties, and the ground shook. It was a panic sent by God. One small note here. Other translations will say it was a great panic. Now, to me, it's a big difference if the panic was sent by God or just a great panic. Just a side note, this is the kind of stuff in the Bible. Be careful. Different translations, different interpretations. Oh, yeah, it was a panic sent by God. Oh, no, it was just a great panic from Jonathan killing 20 people in an outpost where they weren't expecting it. Okay. Who was the guy that said, well, we'll just say it was sent by God? Okay, yeah, write that down. Okay. These are the things that drive me crazy sometimes. Okay. Saul's lookouts. Oh, we're back to Saul. At Gibeah in Benjamin, saw the army melting away in all directions. So suddenly the Philistines are going nuts. Then Saul said to the men who were with him, "Muster the forces and see who has left us." When they did it, it was Jonathan and his armor bearer who were not there. So who the heck has started this whole thing? Oh, my son and his armor bearer. Saul said to Ahijah, who is the priest, "Bring the ark of God." At that time, it was with the Israelites. Pause. Remember, we had this whole story of bringing the ark of God, and the Israelites got trashed when they did it. They lost the battle. Oh, we lost because God wasn't with us in God's box. Let's bring the box. And then they lost even worse, and the box was taken. And the Philistines got tumors, and then they got the box back. So here we are. Oh, go get the ark. If that were what was happening, that's bad. But once again, correction, most translations will say, well, it wasn't actually the ark of God. The Septuagint says it was the ephod. Hey, can someone decide this stuff? So it was actually bringing the ephod, which is what the priest wears with the pomegranates, to determine whether they should do things or not, which we'll get to in a second. So while Saul was talking to the priest, which makes more sense, hey, bring the ephod with the priest, let's find out what we should do, the tumult in the Philistine camp increased more and more. So Saul said to the priest, "Withdraw your hand." So the picture here is, hey, go get the ephod. Wow, things are happening over there. Should we go attack? Priest comes over. God, you know, blah, 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 blah. Saul looks down. Philistines are going more crazy. Hey, retract your hand, which is a better translation. Retract, bring in your hand. Doesn't matter. I can see they're going crazy. We don't really need to ask God. Let's go. Then Saul and all his men assembled and went to the battle. Yeah, enough of the priest. We got this. They found the Philistines in total confusion, striking each other with their swords. So that now they're just killing each other. Those Hebrews who had previously been with the Philistines and had gone up with them to their camp went over to the Israelites who were with Saul and Jonathan. So last episode, everyone left Saul. Now they're all back because, oh man, we're winning again. Let's go back to the Israelites and fight. When all the Israelites who had hidden in the hill country of Ephraim heard that the Philistines were on the run, they joined the battle in hot pursuit. Momentum is building. Everyone's crushing the Philistines again. So on that day, the Lord saved Israel. And the battle moved on beyond Beth Aven. The Lord saved Israel. One could argue, Jonathan and his armor bearer did, but let's give some credit. Okay, great. God was helping them to kill the Philistines and saving Israel. God was there somehow. Now, the Israelites were in distress that day because Saul had bound the people under an oath saying, "Cursed be anyone who eats food before evening comes, before I have avenged myself on my enemies." So none of the troops tasted food. Now imagine, they're fighting all day. They're wiping everybody out. Hard work, carrying around a sword and slashing people with it, hitting shields. And Saul says, "No one can taste food until I have had my vengeance." Now, if we're talking about mistakes of Saul, this one I might be, "Whoa, really? Where'd you come up with that?" And also, is this something kings do? If you do this, you'll be cursed. Was that normal? Apparently it was, because everyone believed it, which again points to the culture we're dealing with here. A king can say, "Cursed be you if you do this," and everyone thinks, "Oh my gosh, we shouldn't do that." I mean, this is very important to get context of a kind of people we're dealing with here. This isn't God. This is a king saying it. Remember the king they wanted? The entire army entered the woods, and there was honey on the ground. I love it's on the ground. It's actually literally a land flowing with honey. It's literally just oozing out of the ground, which is a realistic thing in the Middle East. Not in the combs, it's just honey. When they went into the woods, they saw the honey oozing out, yet no one put his hand to his mouth because they had feared the oath. But Jonathan had not heard that his father had bound the people with the oath, so he reached out the end of the staff that was in his hand and dipped it into the honeycomb. He raised his hand to his mouth and his eyes brightened. His eyes were illuminated. His eyes were vibrant. His eyes, you can just imagine it. Which all of you have a honey stick near you right now, so go ahead and grab it. It's either under your chair or you sat on it, and hopefully it didn't leak onto your pants, or it's in your hand. Now, apparently, if you take a honey stick and you hold it long ways and you just put it in your teeth and pull off the top, you will taste honey. Now, if you're allergic to honey, don't do this. That would not serve the illustration well. If you hate honey, don't do it. But everyone just go take a little sip of honey. And also try not to have honey all over the carpet when we're done. It's not working. Julia, you said it would work. Just bite. All right, anyone tasting honey? Some people? Okay. If you're not, you can... Somebody said it tastes good. It tastes good? Okay. So the honey... It's tasting what? Sweet, like honey does. I mean, I guess it's kind of, we all know what honey tastes like. Again, unless you're allergic to it and have never eaten it. So imagine them, they're starving. They're famished. There's this honey on the ground oozing all over the place, out of honeycombs just flowing on the ground. And they're just, oh man. And Jonathan, does what you just did. Oh, my eyes were lightened. Some of you are like, "I didn't get my eyes being lightened up." That's okay. All right, so. Then one of the soldiers told him, "Your father bound the army under a strict oath, saying, 'Cursed be anyone who eats food today.' That is why the men are faint." Which is interesting that Jonathan didn't ever wonder why no one else was eating. Which makes me think Jonathan probably didn't care much. Oh, that's why you guys aren't eating. Okay. Jonathan said, "My father has made trouble for the country." Ooh, your father the king. "See how my eyes brightened when I tasted a little of this honey. You see what it did to me? How much better it would have been if the men had eaten today some of the plunder they took from their enemies. Would not the slaughter of the Philistines have been even greater? Okay? Again, the enemy for years, always in battle. Man, who the heck would come up with a rule that we can't eat? We really would have won this battle if we would have been able to eat. My father, what in the world is he doing? That day, after the Israelites had struck down the Philistines from Michmash to Ajalon, they were exhausted. Now it's evening, so they're allowed to eat. They pounced on the plunder and taking sheep, cattle, and calves, they butchered them on the ground and ate them together with the blood. Then someone said to Saul, look, the men are sinning against the Lord by eating meat that has blood in it. Again, this is Levitical law. You cannot eat meat with blood in it because blood is the life of the creature. So now, because they were following this oath of their king, they couldn't eat honey. Now, as soon as dusk happens, they're just killing animals all over the place and eating them with the blood in it. And now they're making another big boo-boo. And the priest says, uh-oh, we've got a problem. You have broken faith, he said. Roll a large stone over here at once. Then he said, go out among the men and tell them, each of you bring me your cattle and sheep and slaughter them here and eat them. Do not sin against the Lord by eating meat with blood still in it. So now we're going to go get this thing. We're going to put the animals on here, drain all the blood so that we can eat it. So everyone brought his ox that night and slaughtered it there. Then Saul built an altar to the Lord. It was the first time he had done this. First time Saul has built an altar, he builds it. Okay, hopefully we can save ourselves here. Then Saul said, let us go down and pursue the Philistines by night and plunder them till dawn. And let us not leave one of them alive. So you get the momentum here. The Philistines have always bugged Saul. They've always bugged Israel. I mean, we have them on the run. Let's go. Let's finish the job. At night till dawn, let's not leave one of them alive. Do whatever seems best to you, they replied. But the priest said, let us inquire of God here. So Saul asked God, shall I go down and pursue the Philistines? Will you give them into Israel's hand? But God did not answer him that day. Again, very interesting as to how God did not answer him. But apparently, it's all quiet. So, Saul therefore said, come here, all you who are leaders of the army, and let us find out what sin has been committed today. Because obviously, if God isn't answering, there's been a sin. As surely as the Lord who rescues Israel lives, even if the guilt lies with my son Jonathan, he must die. But not one of them said a word. So suddenly, that was interesting. Jonathan was gone while I was under the pomegranate tree with the priests. God, should we go finish them off? I don't hear anything. Okay, someone has sinned. Everyone, come here. Who sinned? Quiet. I swear, I will kill whoever it is, even if it was my son Jonathan. They must die today. Saul then said to all the Israelites, you stand over there. I and Jonathan, my son, will stand over here. Do what seems best to you, they replied. Then Saul prayed to the Lord, the God of Israel, why have you not answered your servant today? If the fault is in me or my son Jonathan, respond with the Urim. But if the men of Israel are at fault, respond with the Thummim. What the heck are the Urim and the Thummim? Not Uma Thurman. Okay, what the heck is this? So the ephod, the breastplate, had something in it. We don't even know what it was. Maybe a black and white stone, maybe sticks, maybe little carved figurines of some kind. Really, no one knows. But they would use these things to consult the oracle, which is in Bible commentaries. You probably didn't know that. God said this was okay in Exodus. So the priest can come in his ephod with the pomegranates hanging on it, and you can consult the oracle by using sticks or stones or carved figurines, the Urim and the Thummim. One's maybe black, one's maybe white. People say it was dark and light. We don't know, but somehow it's almost like, hey, whatever the thing says, that's what God is saying. Which many people will say came from the Sumerians, the other cultures around them. There was the Tablet of Destiny the Babylonians had, and it worked very similar, and they believed that their god Marduk had imparted wisdom to this tablet of destiny. And many say the Israelites just kind of took this idea and ran with it with their God, which again is very important to remember, that God seemingly somehow is okay coming into culture, whether it's right or wrong, and trying to work something inside of it. Because last time I checked, this does not seem like Jesus. Oh, well, just, yeah, take out the stones and, you know, whoo. Well, the Sumerians did it. Let's do it too. Babylonians did it. I mean, we can do this kind of thing. Okay, so that's what Saul does. Jonathan and Saul are over here. Everyone else over here, draw the thing out and let's see what it says. Which, again, is interesting. When God wasn't speaking earlier, why didn't they just do this? I don't know. It's all very confusing. Jonathan and Saul were taken by lot. Uh-oh, it just points to them. And the men were cleared. Saul said, "Cast the lot between me and Jonathan, my son." And Jonathan was taken. Then Saul said to Jonathan, "Tell me what you have done." Obviously, this thing has shown that you have sinned. That is why God isn't telling me whether I should destroy the Philistines or not. What have you done? Jonathan told him, "I tasted a little honey with the end of my staff, and now I must die." Man. Saul said, "May God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if you do not die, Jonathan." Okay. "But the men," said to Saul, "should Jonathan die?" I don't know who the first one was to ask this. Excuse me? Small question. "He who has brought about this great deliverance in Israel," the guy just went over and kind of kicked some butt with his armor bearer. The whole thing started because of him. Is he really the one who should die? "Never, actually." No, he shouldn't. People are starting to come on board. Yeah, I'm with him. "Never. As surely as the Lord lives, not a hair of his head will fall to the ground, for he did this today with God's help." So the men rescued Jonathan, and he was not put to death. Some say the men ransomed Jonathan. So the men are suddenly, no, we are not killing this guy. Then Saul stopped pursuing the Philistines, and they withdrew to their own land. So suddenly, don't know exactly how they ransomed him, rescued him, but they said, "Nope, you're not killing him." Maybe they said, "We're out of here." And Saul, they stopped the pursuit. And then it says, this little kind of epilogue here. After Saul had assumed rule over Israel, he fought against their enemies on every side of Moab, the Ammonites, Edom, the kings of Zobah, and the Philistines. Wherever he turned, he inflicted punishment on them. He fought valiantly and defeated the Amalekites, delivering Israel from the hands of those who had plundered them. Saul's sons were Jonathan, Ishvi, and Malchishua. The name of his oldest daughter was Merab, and that of the younger was Michal. His wife's name was Ahinoam, daughter of Ahimaaz. The name of the commander of Saul's army was Abner, son of Ner, and Ner was Saul's uncle. Okay. Saul's father, Kish, and Abner's father, Ner, were sons of Abiel. Good to know. All the days of Saul, there was bitter war with the Philistines. And whenever Saul saw a mighty or brave man, he took him into his service. I like how that ends. Remember the warning of what the king will do? You guys sure you want a king? Whenever Saul saw a mighty and brave man, he took him into his service. I want you. Okay, so the story. There it is. And there's actually some cool little elements in there, but this is the question I had. Where is God in the story? Or maybe where do you see God most? Which is actually a very Ignatian question, which is a great question. Where did you see God this week? Where do you see God every day? And here's the deal with the story. I think what frustrates us, or at least me, is all of the places I'm supposed to see God, I don't really feel like I see God. And I think this is very common today. And actually, I think this is why the Bible is so frustrating sometimes. There's these two pieces of the story, in the beginning and the end, and it's all about God and consulting God and figuring out God. And there's all this God language and priest language and religion, and it just feels really confusing and empty. Which, if you go to what we talked about last week and you talk about the Bible a little differently, sometimes you just think, is this a book of what we're supposed to do or what we're not supposed to do? Because it feels like all the time that they're really trying to find God and where God is supposed to be, God isn't. And maybe we make the same mistake today. And we wonder, God, where are you? Because this is where I see God in the story. In the woods, dipping his staff into some honey. I read that and I go, oh yeah, now that seems like God. And what's really interesting is David, who ends up being friends with Jonathan, writes later in the Psalms, taste and see that the Lord is good. You wonder if they talked about this story. Yeah, man, God is like honey. Just taste God and see if it is good. I remember we were out in the woods once, and we weren't supposed to eat this honey, and I ate this honey, and my eyes just, I came alive. Which brings us to our stories today. I mean, I think we all play different roles. Some of us are the Saul in this story, and we are consumed with finding out if God is in this or not. I mean, if you look at this from Saul, he's constantly, it's confusing and almost frustrating. God, are you here? God, should we do this? God, should we do this? Ask the priest. Wait, I can see this. No, don't put your hand down. I'm sitting with the priests because they're the ones that know. Oh, gosh, no one should eat. Wait, we're now breaking God's law. Offer a sacrifice. Should we attack more? I don't hear from God. There must be sin. Who sinned? Jonathan, I'm going to kill you now. Because all of it, bring the ark, bring the ephod. We've got to get God on our side. And it's this constant, it wears me down. It really does. I read these stories and would someone just stop all this? And it's those people who I think sometimes make rules for others. Like, oh, you can't eat that honey. And some of us are Saul. Well, you can't eat that honey. No. I wait till I get my vengeance. Or you can't do that. And if you look at Saul from a grace perspective, Saul has been told all of these things by Samuel, how he's breaking these rules. And so it's no wonder he comes up with more rules, which again is some of us. And I might just say, man, don't live there. Some of us are the men out in the woods with Jonathan. And what's amazing is Saul is the one that said, if you eat, you'll be cursed. This isn't even from God. And yet none of them really asked, are we really supposed to not, will we really be cursed? And I find in talking to people today, there's a lot of people who are still just not doing things because some person told them they shouldn't. And they've never actually bothered to go find out why. Or if it's even valid. And, you know, I know that's a dangerous question, if it's valid, but, man, some of these things are just, what? Where'd you hear that? And what are they missing out on? They're really tired and hungry and famished, and there's honey flowing all around them, but they won't touch it. Well, because I can't do that. Taste and see. I mean, there's the priests, which they've got everything figured out with their Urim and Thummim. Oh, yeah, we'll figure this out. We'll just ask God. Should we go up? Yeah. I mean, these guys are never eating any honey either. I mean, honestly, at the end of the day, can we just be Jonathan? I walk around the world and everyone's really hungry, to use the illustration. They're famished. They're tired. They're exactly those men out in the woods. And we live in a land flowing with honey still, metaphorically at least. And so many people don't eat it because of some stupid reason. And then they wonder why Religion is dead and boring and doesn't really impact their life. Taste and see that the Lord is good when you taste it. And it tastes good and sweet and brightens your eyes and you go, ah, yeah. And lead others to that. My wife was with the Jesuit SEAL program last year, and her spiritual counselor was this lady in her 80s, this just beautiful, sweet woman, the most beautiful, sweet woman you can imagine. And the first time she met my wife, she asked the question, which they asked every time they met, where have you seen God this week? And my wife said, oh, you know. I don't even know if I did. Newsflash, pastors' wives don't always see God. I don't even know if I did. I mean, where did you, Carol? And Carol says, oh, well, you know, I was at the mall this week, and I was buying some leg warmers. And I wasn't even buying them first. I walked by them, and I thought of my little niece, who's away at college. And I said, you know what? She would love these leg warmers. And I bought them, and I sent them to her. And a few days later, I got a phone call from my niece, and she said, Nana, oh, I'm so happy you sent me those leg warmers. You wouldn't believe it. I was just looking online for some leg warmers. And then I got these in the mail. And she said, that's where I saw God. And my wife went, man, I love you. You are awesome. We're so looking for God and all of the stuff. I mean, we're always looking for God in all the places where God is supposed to be because everyone's talking about God and pulling out the ephods and sitting under the pomegranate tree having a big theological conversation and finding out whether we should attack or not and pulling out the Urim and the Thummim. And God is out in the woods dipping your staff in some honey. And God tastes beautiful and delicious. Let's pray. God, help us not to be distracted by religion. And I don't want to be cynical. Religion is not always a distraction. In fact, it's often not. But man, sometimes it is. Help us not to be distracted by all the God talk and all the places where you're supposed to be so that we miss out on tasting you, which seems a lot more like Jesus. God, you are good. You are nourishing. You are liberating. You open our eyes. You bring us light. You make us a light. God, some of us are just plain tired. Probably all of us, actually. Exhausted, famished. Help us to taste you and see that you are good. Help us to be reminded that sometimes it isn't that complicated. We love you and we thank you for your great love for us. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.